You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 261st edition of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we're going to speak to one of Sri Lanka's most celebrated novelists, Ramesh Gunasekara, on his new collection of stories that paint a haunting portrait of post-Civil War Sri Lanka.
Also ahead, we'll meet the master of wine, whose new book sings the praises of natural products. We'll no doubt have a tipple or two in the process.
And before the end of the programme, we'll assess the state of Italy today with the veteran journalist Tim Parks on his new murder mystery.
All that and a look ahead to the week's big news stories and some music too, all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Andrew, another week, another day, another dollar. Mediterraneo, of course, put to bed. A deeply satisfying process for you?
Well, it was quite nice because I disappeared for a week. I went to the Mediterraneo and I left them to get on with it. That was quite good.
Research?
Yeah, I did some research. I went to Greece for a week, which was very pleasant indeed. And I came back and, yeah, Med looks handsome. It's nice to do this newspaper twice a year. We kind of roll our trousers up, put on our flip-flops. And it feels a little bit more casual than the rest of the magazine output. It's a bit sunnier, a bit kind of more relaxed, even more kind of handsome people on the pages. So I like it.
You know, it works for you.
And also, what's not to like?
Well, and we should say, of course, you know, you used to work in newspapers. I did too. I don't do that much or anything, in fact, on Mediterranean. But it's nice to be around the production of a newspaper because, you know, it's a sort of part of the publishing world that's under a lot of pressure, and it's nice to keep the sort of flag flying a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, it's good to have fun with the format. So it's, you know, a large newspaper, it's on great paper, it's nice to have something that you can think, actually, that's good to leave by the pool and get wet and soaked and who cares. It's good fun.
And being sort of summery and Mediterranean-y makes me think of fine wines. And of course, that's one of the things we've got coming up on today's programme, haven't we? A bit of wine chat, yeah, and maybe a bit of wine tasting.
We're going to have some tipples. You promised in the script. Anyway.
It wouldn't be a Sunday lunch without a couple of glasses. Just two or ten.
A pair of tipples would be very nice later on. We'll have those.
Anyway, less of that, Andrew. Behave yourself. I think we should find out what else is happening, not in the week gone by, but in the week ahead, Andrew.
Okay.
Shall we summon somebody to tell us what's coming up next week?
Should we get that mighty Welshman in, Aled John?
Yes, it is time next on the Monocle Weekly to look at the week ahead. And indeed, we are joined by, I can't remember how you described him, Andrew. Was it something like Welsh? Was it Welsh legend? Something I can't.
Welsh wizard.
Welsh wizard. He's that and many, many, many more things.
Well, it's Aled John, of course.
Hello. Hello, Andrew. Hello, Tom.
And you have more notes than I've seen anyone ever come in to do the segment of the show with. You've done proper preparation.
I like to come prepared for these things. Bullet points, highlighted sections. I've underlined a few things.
Even a few pictures. Nuggets.
Have you not listened to how I normally
do this?
Not many
pictures.
That's never going to take off.
Well, okay. I'm just searching desperately for a jingle.
Okay. Where are you going to start?
Okay. Let's... Fairly grim story, that we're covering comprehensively on Monocle 24. It is, of course, Iraq. And... it's one of those stories, obviously, which develops rather grimly each day. There's a meeting of the parliament with an intention to create a new unity government on the 8th of July. That's this coming Tuesday. The context to this is, those who aren't aware of the political situation in Iraq, is that it's effectively a tripartite division. You've got the Kurds, you have the Shiites and the Sunnis. On the 1st of July last week, actually, a similar kind of meeting in the parliament fell apart because the Sunnis and the Kurds refused to vote on a new leader because the Shias hadn't proposed a new prime minister. This is because Nouri al-Maliki, the guy who's in charge at the moment, is seen as a very polarizing, very divisive figure.
And what can we expect to happen this week then?
I have to say, going on the last two times they tried to form a unity government, and this is the second time now, there's a lot of international pressure and a lot of internal pressure as well. I cannot see another candidate being able to sort of assume some role which will increase peace and stability in the nation.
I guess the scary thing is we could see the division of Iraq into, you know, three separate countries, but with kind of ISIS kind of rampaging across it.
Exactly. Actually, there's a quote from the... he's the leader of the autonomous Kurdish regional government, Masoud Barzani. He's also a member, of course, of the Iraqi parliament. He says Iraq is already effectively partitioned and he intends to hold a referendum on independence for the Kurds within months. And that's a move that, if carried out, would spell, as you suggested, the end of the modern state of Iraq, if, obviously, the Kurds vote for separation. And that, in itself, will have huge knock-on effects for the region. Lebanon and Syria, two countries which both have extremely ethnically and religiously diverse countries, will be affected by that kind of a split.
And I think everyone around, the Iranians are concerned, you know, that it seems everyone in the region is worried about what it would mean for them. You know, even the Saudis and the Gulf states are concerned.
Yeah, it's one of those powder keg moments in the Middle East again, I'm afraid.
Is the next one cheerier or bleaker?
Cheerier to an extent, okay. But also...
Measured improvement.
Measured. This is merely an anniversary, but one which will obviously draw our attention because you get amazing footage of North Korea whenever there's a big sort of national celebration, as there will be on the 8th of July as well, because it's the death anniversary of the North Korean founder, Kim Il-sung, founder of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, otherwise known as North Korea. It's the anniversary of his death, which was in 1972. He was leader up until that point. And as I said, the kind of footage you see, it's very easy for people outside of the country, especially in the West, not to sneer, but to sort of chortle along because you see millions, literally millions of people standing to attention, clapping, crying spontaneously.
This is the thing I always find most extraordinary is these astonishing collective outpourings of emotion.
Of emotion, yeah.
Grown men and women all, you know, weeping very openly. And it's part of this sort of shared... It's ritualistic, isn't it, the way that they mark these anniversaries.
It is indeed. And one of the contributors who we have on the radio regularly, on the Monocle Daily, he does an Asian newspaper review, among other things, John Everard. He was the former British ambassador to Pyongyang. And he says... as we were just referring to, it's easy for us to kind of chortle away at looking at these people indulging in these huge moments of mass emotion, but the reality of life in North Korea is actually incredibly bleak. But a moment to remind ourselves of the situation over there on Tuesday, the 8th of July.
Yeah, I always find North Korea one of those places which, you know, you kind of eat up every image and bit of information that comes out, but there's so little and it's so difficult to kind of read what's really going on. I think we've spoken to John many times before. I think even he says, you know, that it's a very difficult nation to kind of understand.
Mm. Yeah, and as journalists, an incredibly difficult one to cover. Something completely different now. Let's change tack. I've got a few sporty things lined up for after. Tom, I know you'll enjoy some of them. One actually taking place on your doorstep where you live in London. You know what
I think I know what this is.
What do they play on your doorstep? Tiddlywinks?
I think it's kind of mass traffic violations more often. No, Alan, you can only be talking, of course, about the Tour de France.
I'll come on to it in a moment because I've got a trip to sports stories.
Yeah, don't worry.
Trip's coming.
Nice. But is that the one that's on his doorstep?
Yeah, well,
you've got a big doorstep.
It's pretty big. It can accommodate a peloton of some 150 riders.
Just a quick note for those who are fans of popular music, as I know you both are.
Fans of popular music? That sounds like something my mother used to say.
Well, this is it. This is the point, because on the 6th of July, in fact, today, the official singles chart is to start including streaming services. So the official charts company is going to start taking into consideration the amount of streams a song has had on Spotify or other sites that the youth are using, such as Deezer. Tom, you're a fan of Deezer, aren't you?
I will only listen to things if they're on my gramophone.
That's
quite cutting edge. I prefer to have an actual chamber quartet playing for me live. but a gramophone.
It will obviously mean that songs which haven't been purchased will now affect people's standing in terms of popularity. What that actual popularity translates as nowadays is...
So that means if you listen to something on Spotify, that will count as a tick.
It will effectively count
towards it. It's a better indicator of what truly is the most popular song of the day, I guess.
It is indeed, yeah. I mean, but then the two most popular songs at the moment are ones that I have to say, I'm revealing myself here. I've never heard of
Tell us what they are.
Bastille's track Pompeii. Heard of that?
No. I know about Pompeii a little bit.
Bored in the
air. That was big news when I was a lad.
And the other one?
The other one, in fact, sorry, this was the 14th most streamed act in the UK. That's
why have you picked the 14th most streamed act in the UK?
I'm
that's random.
What I'm given here. All J. You know them? All J? You must have heard of All J, Tom.
Okay. No. Is that an esoteric keyboard instruction? I don't know.
Who knows?
Okay, and the three sporting events, obviously the 13th of July is the final of the World Cup taking place at the Maracana Stadium in Rio. Obviously, we have no idea who's going to be...
Well, we've got a fairly decent idea now. We're gradually whittling them down, Alad.
Yeah, we're getting there, but it will no doubt be a huge affair and one to pay attention to.
If I win the sweepstake, I might give you both a pound.
Who did you get?
Well, I can't tell you.
I got Honduras. What was that, a long time ago?
I had Belgium. Interesting, hey? Intriguing. Interesting.
Tour de France. Algeria didn't trouble the scorers for too long, did they?
Hey, but I love the Sky TV presenter. Was it on Sky? They called them Al Jazeera. Got confused between Al Jazeera and Algeria.
Oh dear. Oh,
God. Al Jazeera.
One of the pundits
called it
Al Jazeera.
Okay.
That's shocking.
7th of July, Tom, I believe you're going to be on your doorstep with
absolutely. Everyone's obsessed with my doorstep.
With a cup of tea, enjoying the Tour de France because it literally passes through Wolverhampton.
That's right. Well, even today, it's describing its way through the Yorkshire Dales. Beautiful. God's own country. And it will be wending its way down the Lee Bridge
Road. Why are they not in France? Did they get lost?
No, come on, Andrew. They like to start in different countries every de temps en temps, as they would say.
But does this bit really count?
Or yeah,
is it just kind of like
the first three stages of the race proper.
Yeah, this is the third stage. The third stage will be going through Cambridgeshire, Essex, and East London.
It's been in England before.
So they go to a different country for a bit of a holiday first before they go to France.
Yeah, so it'll be sort of two out of every 5 years they'll do a bit of the race.
Then back on the SeaLink ferry across to France.
Yep, that's right, on the Ro-Ro.
Okay.
But today, pretty exciting. So yeah, about mid-afternoon tomorrow, they'll be in Walthamstow.
Do you know, when I first tried to start out in journalism, this is a bit of an aside, but I went for an interview on a job called Ro-Ro, on a magazine. It was called Ro-Ro. It was the magazine for the roll-on, roll-off freight industry. And I didn't get the job.
And there's the winning anecdote of the week.
I think I'm done. No more.
That's lovely stuff. Alan, thank you very much. Andrew, thank you so much for telling us about Ro-Ro magazine.
Oh,
I'll treasure that story.
Okay, that's yours. Thanks, Alan. Bye. In May 2009, the government of Sri Lanka's President Mahinda Rajapaksa declared that its 26-year war against the Tamil Tigers was over. But in the years since the end of one of the world's bloodiest civil wars, the conflict has continued to cast a shadow over all corners of Sri Lankan society.
The author Romesh Gunasekara, one of Sri Lanka's most celebrated novelists, has tried to capture some of these shadows in his new collection of stories, Noontide Toll. Romesh came into Midori House a little earlier this week to explain the process of articulating the aftermath of Sri Lanka's war in fiction. Romesh, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks very much for coming in to see us. Now, we're here to talk principally, I guess, about Noontide Toll. Let me ask you a bit about the sort of the background to the book, because there's a lot of themes and instances in there of people who are reluctant to talk. And of course, whenever difficult histories are written about in fact or fiction, it always intrigues me what the sort of writerly tricks are to do that. How do you go about writing a history which is so much focused around unspoken stories?
I guess the way I chose is to get a fairly garrulous narrator. And what's interesting actually with this situation, if you like, and what Vasantha, the narrator in the book, comes across as, and actually does say in a place, I think, is that he's in a country, Sri Lanka, which is pretty, you know, it has a fairly easygoing atmosphere at one level. And people on the whole are talkative, you know. It's a place where people do talk. I mean, if you meet people, they talk a lot. But of course, there is this unspoken area, and recent history has been very traumatic. And that kind of tension between the unspoken and the garrulousness was something that I thought could work.
And tell me about why you think that is, because it is interesting in some instances of conflict, historical conflicts, that people find that it's a very cleansing, sort of cathartic experience to write about them, to talk about them, to make plays or to have radio or TV. Other countries where it is much more difficult to kind of scratch beneath the surface. Do you think there's something cultural that means that's more difficult? Or do you think it's just the people who are inevitably very guarded because they've experienced so much kind of collateral damage from what's happened?
I think the latter more than anything else, actually. The recent history is talked about and written about, and there are movies, there are films, there are plays, there's satire as well that comes and goes from time to time. But I guess there is, in this particular case, there are two things, I think, that are silencing in some sense. One is quite a long period in which it was in somehow dangerous to be a dissenter or to offer criticism, and dangerous on various fronts. There was not just one force, as it were. And so I think people, you know, there is a sort of reluctance that comes out of that danger. There's a certain amount of suppression, and an increasing amount. And then the other aspect of it, I guess, is to do with the difficulties themselves, actually, and the fact that people take very entrenched positions in a sort of political battle, if you like, or an ideological battle, or a cultural battle, and all of these become very entrenched. And so it's very easy to paint yourself into a corner or into a battlefield, as it were.
And it's obviously very difficult to write elegantly and effectively about issues like, guilt, for example, which I think you do with great flair in the book. And I wondered about writing about guilt and that feeling of, now people often talk about collective guilt, you know, shared social guilt in the years following conflicts. How do you think that in Sri Lanka in particular, guilt and justice and these concepts are all bound together? And was that something that you were very intrigued to explore in more detail in the book?
I am, I think. I'm intrigued to explore how those work. And I don't know, guilt is, I mean, it's a, if you like, a kind of long-standing human feeling that's there in a lot of writing, in a lot of stories explore that whole notion of what did we do, what have we done, what have we not done. And it doesn't have to be political. It can be on a domestic level, whatever. So I think that's a very powerful motive, if you like, in life, really. And I guess here I did want to, I suppose the strongest impulse was this notion of how one maintains a sense of identity, a sense of who we are. I don't mean in a very narrow nationalistic sense, just as human beings, and how much that relies on memory and how much that relies on what has happened in the past. And the tension here, I guess, is with this desire, which is not only a Sri Lankan desire. It's something that you find everywhere. Every government is trying to do it. Every group of people are trying to do it, which is to redefine the past and to rewrite the past, to airbrush history, basically. And that's happening all the time. And it just, you know, on an individual level, one feels, you know, that's a bit of an erosion of oneself, however bad the past may be.
It's interesting you mentioned there, not just in Sri Lanka, but around the world. But I wondered in terms of the sort of island mentality of Sri Lanka, do you think that does, it's a different sensibility, the island sensibility. Is there an island writer's mindset? I mean, it intrigues me. Here we are in Britain, of course.
Yeah, it is. This idea has come up over the years, partly because of the nature of the books I've written, most of them set in Sri Lanka or in Britain or in the Philippines, which are 7,000 islands, you know, and what the relationship might be. And I think there may well be, but I think the idea of the island is much wider than that. And you know, if you think about the idea of islands, you can go completely wild on it and you know, everything. But you know, to kind of bring it back, I kind of think a book is an island, a novel is an island. You enter it and that becomes the world. I'm trying to remember now who it was. It may have been someone like Dawkins or someone who was talking about the idea of the island is where things happen and that it must be him, mustn't it? Evolution and all of that sort of
could,
stuff.
It could
but,
well be.
But what was interesting was I think he was saying something, you know, it was some festival we were at actually, and he was saying something to the effect that an island is like a sort of petri dish, or it's a laboratory. It's where things are slightly intensified, and you can see things happen as they happen. And I think, you know, in a way, that's very true to the idea of art, to the idea of a novel, a play, a film. You know, having those boundaries, and within that, you can just see a little bit more clearly. And then you kind of go on from that to think, you know, okay, islands, we think of islands in a very, we are bound, if you like, by our minds. So we think of islands as these little bits of land surrounded by sea. But of course, that's not it really. Cities are islands. An oasis in a desert is an island. And it is where there is, I suppose, a lot of activity going on together. I was doing another radio thing where talking to a microbiologist who studies microbes, and he was talking about, you know, clusters of microbes and how they behave like people and so. And you can see, oh, there's another island, you know, it's a fantastic thing.
It's amazing. I just want to ask you a bit about that then. You mentioned your own background, of course, from Sri Lanka here in the UK, the Philippines too. When you consider your own writerly skills, where were they fashioned? Do you consider yourself to be a Sri Lankan writer? Do you think it's a more international than that? How does your own experiences, where you've
probably
been shaped?
I mean, it's nice to think, and it sounds rather grand to think on the international scale, but actually it's the other end. It's It's more of an individual thing, really. You know, when I was a kid, I was just a reader. And when I was in the Philippines, I started to write. So in many ways, you could say I'm a Filipino writer because that's where I kind of got the bug, if you like. And that was simply because that was the point. It was that age, you know, 14, 15, that sort of age, when suddenly I realized books were written by writers. And I also started reading those sorts of writers who kind of proclaimed themselves writers, like Ginsberg and Kerouac and, you know, that whole tribe of writers, if you like. So in a sense, the writing started there. But that was playing with writing. You know, I just enjoyed doing that. And it was maybe when I came to England that I suddenly thought, actually, I wouldn't not quite like the idea of not just playing around with the words, but to try and write a book and create that kind of island, if you like. I mean, it just struck me. I mean, another thing about, you know, you ask, is there an island writer? And yes, you know, there is all that business about no man is an island and all that sort of stuff comes into it. But I do remember long ago, I think when my first or second book came out, and they're very slim books on the whole, the ones that I write. They've got a little bit thicker over time. But an Indian writer telling me very, very seriously that, you know, it must be good to come from an island because, you know, you can write about this place in a small way, whereas we have to write these huge epics. And of course, absolute nonsense, you know, but there is that, I don't know, it's just a way you look at the world, you know, whatever works.
Well, it's a very slim but very elegant piece of work. It's Noon Tide Toll. Ramesh Gunasekara, thank you very much for coming to tell us all about it here on the Monocle Weekly.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was Ramesh Gunasekara talking to me a little earlier this week about his new collection of stories, Noontide Toll. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Let's listen to some music now. All throughout the World Cup, which you may have noticed, is taking place in Brazil. We've been looking at the 32 nations through the prism of alternative national anthems, the songs, melodies that capture some of the spirit of those nations today.
Now, for this instalment, we head to Mexico, which was knocked out of the World Cup in Brazil in agonising fashion by the Netherlands. Well, as Manuel Diaz Cebrian, director of the Mexico Tourist Board, now explains, it's a Mexican folk song which became a staple of US rock and roll in the 1950s that continues to capture the essence of Mexico today.
La Bamba. La Bamba. It's actually a very joyful song. It comes probably from bamboleo, which is to shake. So it's La Bamba. Actually, just the name evocates, I guess, the rhythm for you. It's a song from the state of Veracruz, which is so close to Cuba. And it has all these roots in Mexican, African, and obviously Spanish rhythms. And it's one of the most famous Mexican songs. Some people believe it's not Mexican because it's been popular and performed by many American and British singers, and especially Los Lobos, this important group that actually died in a horrendous crash. But yes, obviously due to that, it's been widely popular. We don't know exactly, I mean, much about the history. It was just created as in the state of Veracruz, as I told you. Yes, Veracruz is a coast, very warm and lovely town. The people of Veracruz had the reputation to be a happy people all the time. So this song is about just putting you in a good mood. It was created originally to be only like folkloric dance, and from that jump into a different level. It's in a way, it could be translated, but it's not really social, but it's about talking about people from the coast. It's a sailor, I'm a captain. So it's about, I guess it's about conquering someone and telling this someone that is his range is better than the one she believes she is. And the lyrics are very interesting. It's like to go to the sky, I just need two stairs, one big and one small. It's kind of symbolic. It's kind of a song that, in a way, flirts in order to attract you. That used to be a song performing weddings, but since the music and the lyrics became popular since in the 50s, because it became like a kind of a rock and roll song, it's a song that actually became a song that you dance and actually changed your spirit. And obviously, for any Mexicans, when you listen to La Bamba, immediately you do this. Porque es arriba y arriba y arriba. Yo no soy marinero. It's fantastic. It's a lovely song. It's a song appropriate for the summer. It's obviously a song which is a joyful song. It's a song that actually comes from the coastline. And obviously because it's a song once you listen to, you feel pride and you feel great because it's a song that has transcend frontiers and evocates and means Mexico. If you play that song, actually people will just get crazy and scream and actually just because everybody knows the lyrics of this song. There are so many other songs, like Cucaracha, for example. But I think La Bamba is more like a funny, it's more like an appropriate for this occasion, for the World Cup. I love it. And Mexico is a very musical country, more than a dancing country. We love singing. So I say, well, La Bamba. La Bamba is great.
That was Manuel Diaz Cebrián, director of the Mexico Tourist Board, on La Bamba as the nation's alternative national anthem. And you can hear more of the World Cup alternative national songs throughout the World Cup here on Monocle 24. That's a lot of World Cup, isn't it, Tom?
That's a lot of World Cup, and so it continues. We've got another week and a bit still to go. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Up next, Andrew, what we've all been waiting for. We'll be sampling the delights of some natural wines.
Ooh.
Art as a tool to fix our lives? Alain de Botton believes it is. Monocle Films meets the philosopher in the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam, where visitors are introduced to this new therapeutic look at art.
It's not therapy in the sense of, you know, three times a week on a couch. It's therapeutic in the very loose sense of the word. Sometimes in our own life, we're like up against our problems, we feel a bit claustrophobic. So a picture of a wide open view can for a moment just open our minds and open ourselves to better horizons.
Art is therapy. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. And now we can have a little bit of a tipple, aren't we?
We are indeed. As promised, Andrew, there are wines. You've probably spotted them on the table in front of you. And I imagine, Andrew, you've often wished that your wines were a little closer to nature. Well, Master of Wine, Isabel Legeron, has written a new book celebrating natural, organic, biodynamic wines. And I'm delighted to say she has indeed brought a couple of bottles along with her to Midori House for us to sample. And she's going to tell us all about her new book, Natural Wine, An Introduction to Organic and Biodynamic Wines Made Naturally. Isabel, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
It's interesting sort of leafing through the book, and you make this point in your introduction that we're very used to people talking about organic food, natural food stuffs. People are very aware and sensitive to where their food comes from.
In my experience, you know, I love my food and I, you know, eat out and go to sort of farmers markets and so on. And I've noticed that, you know, we are very sensitive to what we eat and where that piece of meat comes from. We're not really thinking about wine the same way. And I think it's partly because in this country, you know, we're a little bit removed from the production of wine. So we sort of have access to wine through, you know, wine professionals and merchants. It's not so easy to go and hop in and go and, you know, visit a vineyard, although there are more and more wines sort of produced here. So I think, you know, there is this aspect of being a little bit removed from the production side. And also, I think as wine professionals, I think we've been very good at keeping the dream alive that, you know, wine is just grape juice that sprouts off the ground and is fermented naturally and nothing is added. And we've never really gone into the full story of how wine is made. And as such, I think there's a lack of consciousness within, you know, the wine drinker.
Do you think there's also a bit of a gap in the consumer's mind? I think that many consumers kind of think that organic wine probably isn't as good as the rest of the wine in some sense. You know, I remember, you know, 20 odd years ago when organic food came out, you'd see a few kind of ropey tomatoes on a stall and that would be organic food. And now it's, as you know, it's the best stuff you see in store. Has there been a bit of a lag here, you know, that people think that actually organic wines are probably made by somebody in their shed and don't have, you know, the same taste and quality as, you know, the wines they're used to?
I think that's a fair point in terms of what has happened, I guess, over the past sort of 20 years. But I think recently in the past sort of 5 years, there's been a change in the way the wine is made. I think people who started producing organic wines maybe were part of that kind of slightly, you know, hippish sort of community and you know, maybe trying to make wine with less intervention and getting it wrong sometimes. And I think now we're sort of really way beyond this perception. And I hear it often, you know, and I think it's time for us all to really move on, because organic wine, you know, and producers, and in my book I talk about natural wine, and perhaps we can sort of try to explain what's the difference between organic, biodynamic and natural. But, you know, we've really moved on and you know, some of the top estates around the world are indeed, you know, organic.
So before we hand back to Tom, just tell me, what is the difference between all those terms then?
So organic wine really applies to the way that the land is farmed. So we understand what organic farming is. And until very recently, actually, until 2 years ago, pretty much precisely, there was nothing that would regulate what happens in the cellar from an organic perspective. Now, the EU changed that 2 years ago. There was this kind of common EU organic legislation, which is still extremely lax. So in effect, you could have beautifully grown fruits, bring it into your cellar and add yeast, loads of sulfites, pasteurize it, you know, sort of sterile filter it and so on, and add loads and loads of additives and still call it an organic wine. So for me, you know, that is in a way not enough. You know, we need to either work on making the organic certification a lot more strict, or choose other vocabulary, which is what I've done with natural wine, so that these growers who do indeed produce real natural wine, you know, are protected and that it means something. Otherwise, it's going to be exactly like, you know, organic doesn't really mean much anymore. You know, it is, I think, organic production can be quite limiting and is not always as strict as it could be. So I think we need to start looking at what, you know, the word natural actually means and to protect it.
Well, in that context, so natural wine, this can be something of the Bible, can't it, for this new for this new area. Let's delve in. This is the
yeah, sure.
I mean, it's been a great pleasure talking to you so far. Of course, Isabel, but I must say this was
I was anticipating
the highlight.
Don't worry, I have no
and we should say something. But so the book is kind of like a half overview, isn't it, of the, well, we can talk while the corks are being popped and tops being taken off if they come off, but the book is kind of like a half overview of everything that's happened. And then this is amazing selection at the back of bubbles, whites, pinks, reds. What are oranges?
Oranges, yeah, good question. So oranges is a white wine which has been made exactly the same way as a red wine, i.e., you know, the skin is left in contact with the juice for weeks, sometimes months, extracting tannins and then producing wine of actually an orange color. And this way of making white wine or orange wine is as old as wine itself. You know, is the first way we would have made, you know, wine with white grapes some 8,000 years ago.
So this is the first, and this wine is in the book, is one of the recommended wines. What are we having?
So what we're having is a Pétillon Naturel, which is basically, this is...
I'll be generous and pass the first one to Tom.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
There we go, look at that. Wow, lovely sound. So you have a Chenin Blanc, sort of from the Loire. It's 100% grape juice, there's nothing else added. And this is what is called a Pétillon Naturel.
Hold on, Tom. Hold on, Tom is knocking it back already. So he wants the second one.
So Pétillon Naturel, or, you know, the rural method or ancestral method, which is basically you put juice in the bottle whilst it's fermenting, and then the first fermentation finishes inside the bottle, so there's no yeast, no sugar, no additives. So you have quite a full sort of, you know, full-on sparkling. It's quite sort of, you know, ripe pears and this kind of very ripe sort of yellow fruits.
I'm trying to not be rude here. Is it towards the world of cider a little bit more than in its method?
No. It's made...
It's with all grape, but is it, when you say it's fruitier, and is it a little bit more of a common or garden drink than, say, a champagne or something? How would you drink it?
No, I think you can have it as an aperitif. You know, there's quite a lot of body and the acidity is pretty fresh in there. So actually you could have it with, you know, a lot of foods, for sure. This way of making sparkling wine is the oldest way.
Okay.
It actually predates the champagne method or the traditional method. In a way, it's the method that makes the most sense, where you put juice, it carries on fermenting in the bottle and creates the sparkle without, you know, the help of adding yeast, because you know in the juice there are all these yeast that are there and they're waiting to get into that sugar and convert it into alcohol and carbon dioxide.
So it's almost the most traditional way of making sparkling wine. So yeah, it strikes me almost as a wine perhaps that would be very good with cheese. And I wonder whether to natural
wines... As a man who likes cheese.
I like wine and I like cheese. Are they better suited perhaps to enjoying with food, even than some of these overly treated, mass manufactured
wines? Well, you know, in a way, you know, natural wine is... there is this element of they're full of personality. And sometimes I think it's great to have them on their own and just enjoy what's going on their own. But they also work really, really well with food. And I think it's a good call with the cheese. If you had something like, even like a really good, all well-matured, like proper cheddar, I think that would work really well with this. And, you know, you get that kind of slightly sort of, you know, underlying quince notes coming through in the wine.
Sounds delicious.
And before we taste the next one, both of these are French. Now, in recent past, France has been a little bit criticised for being slower to adapt, maybe, to some of the changes going on, that New World wines were in the vanguard. They were doing everything new and crazy and fun, and France was a bit in the old rut. But is this a good old rut to be in? They've gone back to, in a way, to kind of like the basics, finding out how... Is France a leader in making these wines?
France and Italy. And it is precisely because they have stuck to very traditional methods throughout without really rushing into like a lot of the New World countries where, you know, winemaking has come at it from the cellar perspective. It's always been about the cellar and the grape variety more than actually the whole process. You know, the winemaker, even that is just a weird vocabulary. You're not a winemaker. You know, that is really something that's come from more New World countries. Whereas in France and Italy, there is this, you know, long-standing tradition of you know, the vigneron, which is the person who mans the vineyard and makes the wine. So it's the same person who really looks after both elements. And you can't separate them out. So when you hear phrases like, I'm the viticulturist and this is my winemaker, it doesn't make sense to separate out, you know, the process. So by far, France and Italy are...
So we're going to have a red next.
Yeah, so...
And like I said, a redneck, but we're going to have a redneck. We're going to have a redneck.
Hopefully. Well, maybe you'll find it's a bit of a redneck. We'll see.
Okay, I want to look at this one up in the book. So this is in the book and it's under French medium-bodied reds.
Yes. Okay. So if you look in that section, you'll find the name. It's exactly the same vintage as the one in the book. So you can see if you agree with... You know what I said about it.
And here you go. It's from an estate run by Carole, Corinne and Olivia.
Yeah, it's a trio, siblings, you know, young sort of farmers who've taken over after their you know, from their family vineyard. I brought this for you because, you know, there is this misconception that it is impossible to make wine without anything. And, you know, very often you'll hear people say, if you leave wine, you know, to its own device, it will turn to vinegar. And that can be the case. But I think this wine, which is, you know, un-oaked, it's really about the fruit. It's a Carignan base blend. So quite a full-on rich sort of, you know, wine. But, you know, I put it in the medium body because actually the texture is really light and delicate. And there's beautiful acidity because this region is very famous for the schistous soils, which are very acidic, great soils. And then when you taste this, you know, this is so perfumed, perfect. There's no issues whatsoever. I mean, you wouldn't know that this was made completely naturally, really, if you, you know, if you were looking for a fault or because it's completely spotless.
And I like the tasting notes you give, which are very simple. Rosemary, black cherry, licorice. I get that. That's really delicious, that.
Well, there's a lot, yeah, a nice dark fruit. I sort of imagine myself.
It stays
maybe
in the mouth a long time, doesn't it? It's like really kind of a...
On the Camargue, maybe, Andrew, eating a sort of eating some rabbit, something like that.
I thought it was going to be more cheese.
I'm moving on to some other dishes, yeah. I think this is absolutely delicious.
And it's very reminiscent of, like, dried herbs. You know, you walk around in the Garrigue and then you get all these dry herbs as your feet crush the herbs in the summer, and this is really what this wine is about.
So Isabel, before we say goodbye to you, just tell us quickly the book. Why should people buy the book? What will it do for them?
I think people will read this book and they will never look at wine the same way. You know, I think people will start actually looking at, you know, grabbing a bottle and thinking, well, what am I drinking? You know, am I drinking something which is A, farmed sustainably, which maybe is actually not even suitable for vegan or vegetarians, you know, if that's what I'm doing. If you're interested in what you eat, your sourdough thoroughbreds, your craft beer movement, then I think this book is for you. You know, it will really make you question, you know, the whole wine industry, look at it very differently and buy differently.
So, of course, in all good bookshops, but is there a website that people go to find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, I have a couple of websites. One of them is thatcrazyfrenchwoman.com, where there's like full blogs and stuff. And then Raw Fair, because I organise an event every year, which is all these growers going to be there.
I'm glad I asked that question. That one was two good names for websites.
So, yeah, Raw is a festival I organise, and, you know, which is all about transparency. And this is what this book is about. You know, it's about championing transparency. It's about, you know, empowering people so that, you know, they spend 20 quid or 15 or 10 pounds on a bottle of wine. I think people are entitled to know, you know, what they're drinking, because there's no ingredient lists that is obligatory on a bottle of wine, which is the only foodstuff on the shelf where that is the case. So you're buying a bottle of wine completely blind.
Well, more power to you, Isabel. That's Isabel Legeron. The book is Natural Wine, an Introduction to Organic and Biodynamic Wines Made Naturally. And I think we'll all drink to that.
Yeah, great stuff. Thank you.
Cheers.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Now, for some 30 years, the British journalist and author Tim Parks has chronicled life and times of his adopted home, Italy, from a variety of vantage points.
From its railways to its fascination with football, Tim has cast a light on Italy through its passions and also its contradictions. And he's continued the theme in his latest novel, Painting Death.
I'm delighted to say Tim Parks joins us now. Tim, welcome to Studio One here at Midori House, and welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Before we talk about the new book in particular, I just wanted to ask you sort of broadly about writing about Italy, something you've done with great distinction over a number of years now. It intrigues me that there's these different sort of forums that you can use to explain the country, be it using the railways or football. Is there one that's the best thing that dilutes the Italian experience for an Englishman abroad?
I don't think it's a question just of an Italian experience. A country is such a vast, complex mix of behaviour patterns and so on, that somehow all fits together. And the longer you stay there, the more you kind of understand that this had to be like this, and things surprise you less. So the problem really is always trying to find a way in, you know. Most of the time I'm not actually looking to write an Italian book, but every maybe 5-6 years you suddenly think, yeah, that would be really fun to do, just to put it all together by thinking about the railways and all the trips you've done and how it's all changing, but somehow staying very Italian and so on. So, you know, the same with football. There just came a moment when it just suddenly seemed like a good idea, whereas I would never sort of take the country on just the whole thing. I think that would be a very bad idea.
And Tim, tell me, what's the view of Italians, of an outsider coming into the country and writing about them? I know in the past I've interviewed writers, and perhaps because they've kind of tended to go there to write about, you know, organised crime or some kind of scandal, the Italians actually get a little bit kind of wary and weary even of kind of outsiders. But your kind of books are a nicer line of kind of explaining, not reverential certainly, but kind of more inquisitive about the country. Have you been adopted to the bosom of Italy?
Well, I'm an honorary citizen of Verona, so that's a positive, I suppose. In general, there are two kinds of books about Italy. Yes, there's the whole thing's corrupt and it's a huge conspiracy. And those are usually very journalistic books, dark heart of Italy sort of books. And then on the other hand, there are books that are just crushed lemons under my feet and oranges in Tuscan hills. And the whole thing just is sort of perfumed, and there are lots of restaurants and swimming pools. And since I've actually lived there since I was 25 and, you know, been employed there and worked there and had neighbours there and so on, my approach is very different. It's probably even a little bit more kind of an intrigued anthropologist sort of look at it. And in general, the books are published in Italy and enjoyed, yeah.
If you then turn your hand to writing fiction, then is it a different discipline? How do you prepare when you write these books that are not, you know, journals? I guess in that sense, is your writerly experience the same, or do you deploy different sort of strategies for writing? How do you make it work?
Well, I'm a novelist more than a non-fiction writer. I certainly started writing novels, and the novels that all my heart and soul is going into were very serious novels. And even before being published, I would also fool around with other stuff that, funnily enough, in the end actually comes out pretty serious too in its funny way. And one of the things I fooled around with after about 4 or 5 years in Italy was a book called Cara Massimina, which was just about an English teacher who feels he can't ever penetrate this wonderfully decorous and ritualistic society. And in the end, ends up killing to try and get into it, as it were. I mean, there were obvious kind of murmurs of Patricia Highsmith and so on. But although this is much more comic than Patricia Highsmith, it's a completely different discipline, although there's a certain amount of overlap between the books. I think a lot more of my own feelings about Italy actually come across in the novels than in the other ones.
I was going to ask you about the new book. It's called Painting Death, and the kind of anti-hero is called Arthur Duckworth. So why has he been retired by you for almost like 20 years? It's a character you've kind of left in the shadows for quite a while before dragging him back onto the stage.
Well, actually, it's Morris Duckworth. Arthur Duckworth.
Morris Arthur Duckworth.
M-A-D. Well, you know, I wrote this book, the first Morris book, Cara Massimina, in 1984. It was published in 1992, I think, because I left it in a drawer for a very long time, and then it got published. And then 5 or 6 years later, since he was involved in a family with three sisters, which was a real family that existed, actually, he had been involved with one, and then he was involved with another in the second book. And so it was obvious that there was another book to write about his involvement with the third sister. But I must say, it was only a few years ago when quite a serious critic said to me, "Tim, you know those books about Morris Duckworth? I think they were, you know, he was very happy with them." So I thought I would go for it. And it's kind of fun bringing back a character in middle age, who's been, you know, a killer and who's got away with everything, and then imagining him a very stable and honourable member of society. Yeah, it was fun to do, and very Italian, I think.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because you talk about him as if it's a life being lived, almost beyond the control of your pen. Do you see your characters that way when you're writing fiction? Did you sort of feel like he's been busy doing things and it's almost like you finding out as well as creating his next steps?
When you write fiction, although you're aware that the character is not real, I think you have to make a certain investment in it. And of course, the curiosity with this character is that he was clearly a sort of perverse and crooked alter ego from the start. And then I brought him back 5 years after, or maybe actually it was 10 years after the first writing of the first book, because there was such a long period between writing it and publishing it. So bringing back after all these years, yes, it was almost as if we had parallel lives in the same city, and it was just kind of curious that we'd never got to meet.
I'm judging, or I'm hoping that underneath your paving slabs in your garden there are not too many. Sure, let's hope the similarities kind of end there. But tell me, you've used him as this kind of anti-hero. As you say, he's got a kind of a dark past and many skeletons rattling in his cupboard as the new book begins. What's the benefit of you as a writer of not kind of just turning to a hero who discovers murders, or to somebody who is a bit of kind of cleaner cut? What's the benefits for you as a writer having this person who's got such a dark side to him as well?
Well, you know, I think that goes back to one's own background and the whole way one feels about writing. But it's quite clear with my work that I like to present somebody who is a more negative version of myself, because on the one hand, you get a lot of energy and sympathy invested in this figure. And on the other hand, the reader feels he really can't quite identify with this figure. So that you will never find in my writing that sort of easy, "we love this man and everything's okay" feeling. And similarly, you very rarely feel, "well, we don't love him and he's horrible, and so that's easy too." There's always a sort of anxious tension about why we like the guy when he's clearly not a guy we ought to like.
Tim, I just want to ask you again about the sort of your experience as a writer. Then you talked about these stories kind of unfolding almost in an organic way, be they sort of travel writing or your novels. It just seems, it's fairly instinctive, it seems to me. Did you have a preference then, whether you're writing fiction or writing, what would you call them, more sort of journalistic books? Do you enjoy one more than the other, or do they all have their different sort of characteristics that you can enjoy in different ways?
I think the thing is simply, that once one's done one book that's very, very intense, for example, a novel like Destiny that I wrote, or a novel like Cleaver, which were very, very powerful, intense books, it's then wonderful to write a book like Italian Ways about the Italian railways and just move into a different part of your personality. But it is wonderful. I do like writing fiction more. I feel more excited by what I'm doing. I feel the risks are higher. I just feel it's trickier, it's more dangerous. And above all, when you start writing something that you think the publishers absolutely won't want, but that you want to do, that is when you really start getting excited, when you're taking a risk, yeah. I mean, I remember when I wrote a book, Europa, which was on the booker list many years ago, it was really like that. Who on earth is going to want this book? But I really want to write it. And then, funnily enough, often those are the things that people really, really like.
And Tim, perhaps finally, I can ask you, you know, we have, as you say, you're not doing that kind of genre book about kind of lemons underfoot. Italy is changing like much of Europe. You know, there's a big discussion about, is all Europe becoming the same? But kind of when you go to Italy, you realise it's not. But as you look at Italy today, a country you've got to know so well over all these years, what do you think is the future for Italy? Are you confident in the post-Berlusconi world? Do you feel that the country is at a turning point? Do you feel that things are being lost? We see the new Pope, all sorts of things going on. What's your snapshot of Italy, its health and its vibrancy as a culture?
Italy has been in free fall for about the last 5 to 10 years. And the speed of the fall is accelerating. We have 50% of young people unemployed, and the country is in a very desperate depression. The only positive thing, vaguely positive, is that for the first time for many, many years, we have a prime minister who's actually willing to take responsibility and power, and who seems to genuinely be trying to get a few things done. But I don't have really very much confidence at all in the immediate future in Italy. Really not. That said, I've lived there 33 years, and obviously I have a big investment in it. I'm not leaving, but I don't feel confident about it at all, no.
Well, thank you. A slightly dark note, but a slightly dark book as well. Painting Death by Tim Parks is out now. And thank you, Tim, very much for coming in to see us.
Thanks a lot.
And that is all for edition 261 of the Monocle Weekly.
What a show that was, Andrew. I felt it had light and shade, different texture, and that was just the drinks.
Yes. She's amazing. She's a really fascinating woman, and she was a great sports, bringing all the wine. And just really interesting to talk to. That was, of course, Isabel Legerand. And then it was nice to kind of pop over the border to Italy and Mr. Parks. Mm. Really fascinating, because I think people have a misconception of him as being, well, actually, no, that's not fair, of people who write about Italy as being, as he said, people are kind of imagine there's lemons under the feet, and it's all kind of like Tuscan hills. But in fact, it's a tough country with lots of difficult things going on. And what's interesting is he's happy to reflect on that.
Well, yeah, and in fact, he can sort of, yeah, shed those romantic tendencies, though, of course, he can capture them and has done so beautifully in a lot of his work, but he can be very pragmatic. Maybe you can be more pragmatic almost as an outsider on the inside than you can be if you were an Italian writer. Maybe it's a bit easier to have that kind of...
Yeah, and amazing when you've been there that long, because, yeah, in fact, you know, Italians, I know, respect his opinion, and really fascinating.
I think it was a very nice show.
Good, and you've got a nice novel as well to read about Ceylon when you get home.
Exactly, perfect. Let's give thanks not just to Isabel and her wine, but also to our show's producer, Thomas Lewis, and our studio manager, Claire Urban. Though, if you look through the glass now, Andrew, look.
They're both plastered.
They've stolen some of our wine. I don't know what Thomas Lewis is doing in there. Heaven forbid. We will be back next week. Well, it may not be me. Who knows? But I think you might be in the chair again, Andrew. Is that right?
I believe I am actually here next week.
Super. Well, Andrew will be back a week today on Sunday at noon again, London time, with the next installment of The Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye.
Goodbye.